Good evening, everyone. We hope you enjoyed your meals, and welcome back to our evening session. We have our first speaker for this session that I will introduce. If you notice, we have a student speaker at the beginning of each session to remind us that these are our current and future leaders. So I'd like to introduce Rachel Bowman. Rachel is a senior psychology major here at Eastern Mennonite University, and she will be speaking briefly on the topic of how can our Anabaptist identity empower us.
Thank you. So I've been asked to respond to the question, how can our Anabaptist identity empower us? But in order to answer that question, I feel that I must first pose a different question. How do we keep empowerment from turning into domination? How is being empowered different from being in power? And I would argue that the key here is understanding privilege. And it seems to me that Mennonites have a sort of strange and contradictory history in terms of Mennonites, or in terms of privilege, I apologize. So maybe some of you grew up learning about the great Anabaptist martyrs in Sunday school. Maybe you had grandparents telling stories of their parents or grandparents being forced out of Europe because of their faith. Maybe you even heard stories of discrimination your parents or grandparents faced as COs during the war. But what about us now? What about American Mennonites of today? Because the truth is, many of us have acquired power. We've acquired wealth, and we've acquired privilege. And I think we've forgotten what it feels like to be marginalized. Though I insert here that I don't intend to discount any individual's experience of discrimination in whatever capacity it may have been experienced. I mean to speak as a collective whole as Anabaptists in America today. So, we have a collective history of having been marginalized. How do we become empowered in our identity without letting our newfound privilege lead us to overpowering others? What does that balance look like? I recall thinking about this balance when I was on my cross-cultural to the Middle East last spring. We were visiting a Holocaust museum, and our tour guide, a Jewish Israeli himself, was pretty openly talking to us about many of the injustices the state of Israel has put Palestinians through, be it land grabbing, water shortages, or even highly policed borders. And what he then said has stuck with me ever since. He said, of all people, shouldn't we as the Jews be sensitive to the suffering of others? And this is an example where the balance has been tipped. Many Israeli Jews live with a sense of needing to be in control. Dominating their Palestinian neighbors is a way of coping with generationally transmitted trauma of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. When formerly marginalized people find themselves in positions of power, a new series of issues come to the surface. Having been dominated by others, individuals and institutions, they now suddenly have the opportunity to be the ones dominating. And as humans, we can understand the appeal of feeling powerful, of claiming control after having been oppressed. But back in the States, a conversation I was having with a friend of mine illustrated a different way of dealing with this newfound power. We were in the car driving down 42, talking about white privilege, typical afternoon conversation. And in that conversation, I was struggling with what to do about the privilege I have as a white, middle-class individual who's deeply passionate about issues of racism and our criminal justice system. I wanted to do something about these issues, but I identified that I don't have firsthand experience. These realities are not my own. And the friend I was driving with, a person of color, then told me that in order to understand I would have to draw on the ways that I've been marginalized. Not in a comparative sense that suggesting what I face is the same or similar to a person of color experiencing injustices in our society, but as a way of connecting to the emotion, to the sensation of being marginalized. And for me, that meant becoming aware of how my life has been shaped by my biological sex. There are fears and anxieties that I face every day because of the realities of patriarchy. Some men may live their entire lives never having to think about many of the same issues that I face daily, that women face daily. And that is privilege. Privilege is the ability to not think. Privilege is the freedom to not see something as an issue. A person of color is forced to be aware of race. Women are constantly reminded that they are women. But Mennonitism, that you can hide. Our beliefs are not apparent on our physical bodies. In fact, our pacifist beliefs can lay pretty comfortably hidden when we reside in a country defended by one of the world's largest militaries. But why do we hide it? Is it to avoid marginalization? Let us instead be empowered in our identity, empowered to see the suffering of others. Now, that's not to say that Mennonitism is a get-out-of-jail-free card from all kinds of privilege. I have privilege as a white, wealthy individual, and I have to be honest about that. But at the same time, I can hold on to my Anabaptist identity as a way to remember that suffering is a part of my religious and cultural narrative. Let us be empowered in that identity of past suffering, empowered not to dominate, but to do good. Because our ancestors suffered and we survived, we now benefit from privilege in this society. We must be attentive to the ways that our newly found privilege can be oppressive to others. And since our ancestors suffered, that makes those who suffer today our family. Let us seek to live in a type of empowerment that invites everyone to share in that power. Because to me, there's no better way to honor both our history and be relevant as Anabaptists in the modern world.
Powerful words, Rachel. Thank you. So now it is my pleasure to introduce our evening keynote speaker, Brian Welch. Brian is a rancher and entrepreneur. He is also the CEO of Be the Change Media, a multimedia platform company focused on business as a force for good in the world, which he founded last year in cooperation with B Lab and B Corporations. Previously, he ran Ogden Publications, Inc., the owners of Mother Earth News, and a certified B Corporation and winner of several awards for corporate environmental stewardship. Brian will be addressing the topic Faith, Purpose, and Commerce, Inspiring Change in the New Millennium. Please join me in welcoming Brian to the stage.
Thank you, Roxy, and thank you, Rachel. That was terrific. I thought it was great insight. I was a little intimidated. Actually, I felt a little intimidated by my whole dinner, the gathering of people you all have brought to this event, and the size of the audience tonight speaks a lot to the university. My daughter went to Bethel College, and I was calculating earlier today, I think, my wife and I over the years have consumed a total of about $1 million worth of private university education. And by far the best value was Bethel College, and I'm certain, absolutely. So my mentor was a 300-pound Jehovah's Witness, a Navy veteran with the kind of really bad tattoos you seldom see in public anymore. His name was Tim Posey, And Tim owned a trailer park, what we then called a trailer park, in Anapa, New Mexico. And Anapa, New Mexico is on the Mexican border, not too far from El Paso, Texas. And it is, by most people's standards, a terrible place. Poverty-stricken, in the Chihuahuan Desert, surrounded by dumps and hazardous waste incinerators, basically. But I lived there next to the Posey Trailer Park, and Tim Posey had chickens and guinea hens and goats and horses and a huge vegetable garden. And for me, it became magnetic. So when I was 7 or 8 years old, I'd wander over there and look at the watermelons growing and visit with the goats and watch the chickens do what chickens did. And I was just mesmerized by it. So Tim, probably in order to just get me out from underfoot, put me to work taking care of the dairy goats. I might be the youngest native-born United States citizen whose first job was goat herd. And I took this little flock of dairy goats into the desert every day, and they ate mesquite beans and bunch grass and the paper off of the outside of tin cans in the dump and whatever they could get a hold of. And then I took them back to the barn and milked, and they gave this delicious, rich, creamy, astonishing milk, and my dad paid me for it. And I thought that was magic. And Tim also let me help in the garden, which in that case was mostly around fertilizing, which was to scrape everything out of the chicken coop. It's a very large chicken coop. To half-fill a 55-gallon drum with said scrapings, and then to we would put a hose in it and create a slurry, and my job was to stir. You all are more agriculturally aware than most audiences. The experience was profoundly memorable. Stirring, bending over with your head inside of a 55-gallon drum, stirring a chicken shit slurry on an August afternoon in Anapa, New Mexico. You'd never really lose that, right? And then we would pour that in with the irrigation water and grow watermelons and corn and cantaloupe, and all kinds of beans. And it was magic, you know. Anapa was not known for its soil, as you can imagine. But with the addition of the scrapings, it grew astonishing vegetables. And I think what happened to me, and Tim's idea about growing his own food was based in his faith. His faith suggested that it was a sacred duty and a sacred enterprise to create food for yourself. And so he did it with that kind of mindfulness, I think. Tim, this was before the invention of the UV-rated sunglasses, right? And so at that time, when you wore sunglasses and it was really bright out, you did what Tim did, is you bought the darkest prescription sunglasses ever made. And I had known Tim for about 10 years before I saw his eyes. But my interpretation of his behavior, even though I couldn't see his eyes, was that he took this sacred responsibility seriously and he did it mindfully. And I think he modeled something for me that remains important to me. And that is, we have the opportunity of bringing faith to work with us. We have the opportunity of instilling purpose in what we do. The Buddhists talk about chopping wood and carrying water. And doing these, they never talk about stirring shit slurry. But I think it's the same kind of thing. One can do it with this sense that you're engaged in something to be taken seriously and to be done with meaning and done with purpose. And it's quite an addictive experience to do that. About 20 years ago, I took over a company, started a company, and then took over some businesses that published magazines. And a couple of years after that, this remarkable thing happened to me. It goes back. When I was in college, I was home for a few weeks from college, went back to school, and my mom's cleaning out my room, and she used to tell this story. She was rummaging around, cleaning up my room, and she got down on the floor and looked under the bed, and sure enough, college boy, home from college, there's a stack of magazines way back underneath my bed. So she got the broom and swept those things out of there, and I think she was a little disappointed to find that it was Mother Earth News. I was sicker than she thought I was. But then, a couple of decades later, I had the chance to acquire Mother Earth News for my company and to run it for 15 amazing years. And Mother Earth News was the most vivid embodiment of the passions that I had developed in the back lot at the Posey Trailer Park that I could have imagined in the media business. It did. It reflected my own values so perfectly. And it swept me up in that experience of working every day on things that were very meaningful to me and made me feel quite strong, quite strongly that everyone should have the opportunities of feeling for their work that way. Mother Earth News came to us at a fascinating time in the media business, and if you'll pardon me, I'm going to go into the weeds of the media business for a second. What was happening at the time was the digital media were being invented, and everybody in the legacy media, the traditional media, everybody's a little concerned that we were going to cease to exist. But what we found, those of us who did things like I did, was that the best place possible to meet people who are passionate about what you're passionate about, of course, is this thing called the internet. And there are hundreds of ways of reaching out and meeting those people. And so Mother Earth News was a unique voice in the media business, and there was a unique audience for it. So we went to work using the digital media as a way of connecting with those people. Comedians, before they make their HBO specials, they go out on the road and they do dozens of dates in smaller places where they can see the faces of the people they're talking to. And they learn how to tell their own jokes. The digital media gave people like me the opportunity of watching your faces while you read the stories we produce. And we do that by following Google Metrics, which tells us how deep on every page you scroll. It tells us how long you stay on that page. It tells us we can survey you with profoundly insightful corporate media tools called dignified things like SurveyMonkey. And so suddenly we had a real awareness of what y'all were reading and how you were reading it. And we could survey you and you'd tell us what you liked. And you told us some really weird stuff about Mother Earth News. You told us that you didn't like seeing pictures of people on the cover of Mother Earth News, nor did you particularly like profiles of people in the magazine. Now, back in Journalism 101, had I taken it, they would have taught me that stories about people are the thing. You know, every sports story should be about people. Every business story should be about people. But for some reason, profiles of people weren't working for us. But we followed that, and we followed those instructions. And over that period of the 2000s up through the early 2010s, this amazing thing happened. So for one thing, our sale on newsstands grew 93% in the 5 years between 2007 and 2012, while the national newsstand revenues for all magazines combined declined 37%. There's a point to this beyond self-aggrandizement, okay? Hold on just a second. Our average circulation grew 41%, that's paid circulation. Our audience, thanks to the digital media, grew 211% in those 5 years. Oh, I'm going to wait for a moment on that one. I tantalized you, though, didn't I? Between the years of 2003 and 2013, the fastest-growing large magazine in North America, according to syndicated research, this is for the 10 years between 2003 and 2013, the fastest-growing magazine in North America was about chickens and dairy goats and solar collectors. That's really, really weird. Here's the other weird thing. In 2013, at the end of that period I just told you about, the syndicated research folks, they asked a new question. They asked our audiences, all these 200 magazines, do you consider yourself somewhat liberal, very liberal, somewhat liberal, neutral, somewhat conservative, or very conservative politically? And the Mother Earth News audience said it usually thought of itself as very liberal twice as often as the average American. That's what that index means. That our readers were 1.95 times as likely to say they were very liberal as an average American, and they were 85% more likely than the average American to consider themselves very conservative. So in round numbers, twice as likely to say they were very liberal and twice as likely to say they were very conservative. Now, what the heck is that? And we look back over what we had been learning from the readers about their preferences. And we had learned to say sustainable instead of green. And we had learned to put a solution, a personal solution, in every story about a problem and to put it up high. And we had learned not to run pictures of people on the cover. Why? Well, I don't know for sure, but I have a pretty good guess. It's because when we ran a picture of a person on the cover, every person looks like the member of a tribe. And so it alienated a big percentage of our readers who didn't perceive themselves as members of that tribe. That thrilled me, really, because what it meant was that our growth over that decade had been generated, had been created, because we accidentally found this enormous audience of deeply conservative people who care very deeply about the environment, who care very deeply about doing the right thing. And no one except us was talking to them. And we were only talking to them accidentally. We didn't intend to talk to them, but we did. The percentage of Mother Earth News editors that consider themselves any form of conservative is zero, and it was throughout the period I described. So it really was, you know, we were seeking out an audience who cared about what we cared about, and to our surprise, neither we nor they thought we were anything alike, but we were. About a year ago, you know, your mid-50s is an awesome time to risk everything that you've accumulated, including your reputation, and embark on something brand new and extremely risky. And so that's what I decided to do a year ago. I don't know how risky, really. But I was swept up in, about 2004, I met a guy who was talking about inventing something he was going to call a B Corporation. His name is J. Cohen Gilbert. And Jay's idea was, look, everybody wants to do the right thing. Everybody wants to do the right thing. Well, that rang a bell for me because I was meeting a lot of people who wanted to do the right thing. That's what my whole company basically did, was seek these people out. And we were finding lots of them. He said, if people believed that by moving their dollar from here to over here, they could make the world a better place, the vast majority of people will move their dollar from here to over here. Not the vast majority of liberals, well, yes, them, but the vast majority of everybody, because the vast majority of human beings want to do the right thing every day. The problem is, mostly, what we hear about companies doing good in the world is BS. Most of it originates in the marketing department. Most of it is some idea cooked up by the marketing department, and then the CEO coerces cooperation out of all the other departments to make it real enough so that you can sell it in the marketplace. Jay's idea was, hey, we can create an assessment. We can do accounting on this doing good stuff. We can create a score for whether a company treats people and the environment and communities in a respectful and positive way. And so he went about trying to do that. Now, coincidentally, in about 2004, I had come up with this idea for a media company talking about businesses doing good in the world. But I had a big problem as a storyteller. My big problem was that most of what was out there was marketing, and I had no means of telling the difference between marketing and commitment. I had no means, no objective means, of measuring a company's commitment. And some of my investors reminded me of this fact, and I agreed with them. I couldn't build the kind of stories, I could not tell the kind of stories I wanted to tell without more muscle tone in those stories. I looked into what it would cost to build an assessment of some kind, the, you know, good housekeeping seal of approval, as it were. It was tens of millions of dollars to do it meaningfully because of the breadth of data you're talking about. You're talking about environmental data, engineering data, human resource data. It was just enormous. And so I walked away and did other things. Jay, on the other hand, went ahead and did that. Raised money from philanthropy, sold his company, engaged some of his friends, to my great amazement, in basically promising to never do another career-oriented thing in their lives, because they thought it was important that everybody know that they were forming B Lab and certifying B corporations with no interest in ever materially gaining from its existence. So the three founders, Jay and his friends Bart Houlihan and Andrew Kassoy, have contractually promised never to gain materially from the existence of B corporations. And that I find that extremely impressive. And I found it so impressive that when they came back to me again for the 15th time to talk about this idea of a media company that focused on business doing good in the world, I thought, you know, I got my competitive juices flowing. If these guys will take that kind of plunge, maybe I should too. More importantly, I thought it was so cool. I want to be part of it. So, about a year ago, we started fundraising, and January 1st or thereabouts, we launched Be the Change Media, my new company. And we focus on business doing good in the world, which, well, every other business medium that has ever existed built its stories around a central myth of the rapid acquisition of wealth. If you read the Wall Street Journal, or you read Bloomberg, or you read Fast Company, or you read Forbes, almost every story has a score in it. And the score is how rich did somebody get how fast. And that's the unimpeachable good that most business journalism is about. It struck me that we could build stories around an entirely different mythology. And if I tell a business story around the mythology of business doing good in the world, it's a completely different kind of story. Furthermore, my 500,000-pound, 2,000-pound gorilla competitors, Forbes and Fast Company and Fortune, are not going to be able to pivot in my direction, because they've built huge audiences who come to them for stories about getting incredibly rich very fast. And it's not very easy to pivot away from your central mythology when you're a storyteller. And so it looked to me like a virtually wide open track to run on, and like the most exciting project I'd ever encountered. So away we go. Best data we have in the United States, about 60 million consumers say they seek out companies that align with their values. And remember, they seek them out believing they can identify them. And the number, if more people believe, the number would be much bigger, I think. Practically all of the millennial generation has this in their DNA. Considering they're completely worthless baby boomer parents, people like me, I'm astonished they turned out so well. And I compare their community spirit and their ethics and their morals to ours. And I'm, they figured out the most vivid and devastating rebellion of any generation, right? They've decided to be way better than us. And about 15% of all assets under management are in things that call themselves socially responsible investments. Now, B-Lab also has a thing called a GEARS rating that will tell you how socially responsible they really are, and there's a range of that. But all of those $6.6 trillion are aimed at that segment. And what the B Corporations do is they set this objective. So the impact assessment is nearly 500 questions. It takes at least days to complete if you have a very small company, sometimes weeks, months, years. There are almost 1,700 certified B Corporations as of this morning. There are about 40,000 companies who've taken the assessment but not yet certified. They don't make the grade yet. So 40,000 companies that are in the process and want to get there, 1,700 certified companies. This is an old slide because that number's up 100 since I last fixed it. A benefit corporation is different from a B corporation. But if you're a B corporation, then you have to become a benefit corporation if there's a if you have legal status in your state. And what I mean by legal status is benefit corporations change their bylaws to include a statement about mission, which protects their management in case, let's say, the managers, the founders, decide to sell the company for less than absolutely top dollar to a more mission-aligned buyer. Right now, in most places, a conventional corporate board of directors can then sue the management for having not returned the maximum number of dollars to them, because under corporate law, the only way you can define value in business is how many dollars do the shareholders get. That's traditional corporate law. What the enabling legislation for benefit corporations does, and it exists today in, I believe, 39 states have enabling legislation. All of that legislation passed in the last 3.5 years and advocated by B-Lab and by my partners. That legislation, if you become a benefit corporation, get the legal status, then protects management. And if you're a B corporation, it's mandatory for you within 4 years of becoming a B corporation. There are now about 40,000 businesses that use the B Corp standards to measure their own performance and are working toward certification. And those companies have about 40 million registered followers and users, so about 40 million consumers that are connected to those companies in some way, all of whom I plan to email in the very near future. So don't be surprised if you get an email from me in the very near future, and please either give me your credit card number or send in a check. The basic comparison is business magazines. There are about a dozen major business magazines in the country about all these different things. They all identify different audiences. Inc. is about small business. Fast Company is about fast-growing business. And we're about good business. And these are some of the B corporations that are supporting us in various ways. But just to give you an idea of the folks I work with. You want to talk, and also to give you an idea of how poorly I know how to manage fonts in PowerPoint. Now that I notice. So that's the end of the straight propaganda. David, do you want to take control of the slideshow from here on out? There you go. Just when you get bored, just change slides. The rest of the slides are of my farm and my family, and only relevant in that obvious way that you all understand. So what do I think is happening here? I think that there's one species in the universe that can conceptualize its own impact on its habitat. As far as we know, in the entire universe, one species can conceptualize its impact on its habitat. And you, my very fortunate friends, are present at that moment in human history when we are being forced to take responsibility for that capacity for the first time. Until now, we have ingeniously increased the supply of food and clean water to ourselves, not ever in enough quantity, but enough that we continue growing our population. We pay what most of us perceive as a relatively small price. But we are present for this moment when reality is coming to visit and the limits are on us. You know, the human population has doubled in my lifetime. In my lifetime, it's doubled. And it's on course to double again in the next 50 years. And there's very little being done to prevent it from doubling again. And every day there's more and more pressure on the systems. But I feel incredibly optimistic. In part, I feel optimistic because it strikes me as the best strategic and tactical option. No one's ever been here before. We're the only species with the capacity. We haven't grappled with this yet, so you cannot handicap this horse race. There's no evidence one way or the other. And it strikes me that optimists are much more attractive to follow than pessimists. If you want to lead, optimism is part of your toolkit, because nobody follows a pessimist. Also, it's a lot more fun on a daily basis. So why not? But when people say, oh, what about climate change, and what about species extinction, and what about pollution, and what about population growth? I say, I don't know. We haven't figured out all the solutions yet. But I think about the history of human flight. And you know, we went 3,000 years of recorded attempts to fly. For 3,000 years, we gave ourselves concussions, spinal fractures. For 3,000 years, we melted the wax and fell to earth in infinite numbers of ways. 3,000 years. And then these brothers, these bicycle mechanics in North Carolina, made that goofy glider pick up and fly for, I don't know, a couple dozen yards on the beach at Kitty Hawk. And 6 years after the Wright brothers, you could buy a ticket on an airplane to take you across the Tampa Bay. 6 years after the Wright brothers, airlines were a business. 66 years after the Wright brothers, we went to the moon. 66 years, 3,000 years of complete and total failure, right? And 66 years from the first little glider flight to the moon landing, right? So who am I to say that, I mean, how could anybody conclude that we are not capable of meeting the next enormous challenges we face? We are the most imaginative, powerful, extraordinary species that any of us has knowledge of. And it's time we're being challenged to bring all those capacities to bear. One problem we have reminds me of the story of the two women who are at work together, and they meet at the water cooler, and one of them says, oh, I just committed the most embarrassing Freudian slip. And a friend says, what's a Freudian slip? She says, you know what a Freudian slip is. It's when you want to say one thing, and then you say another thing because you have it on the back of your mind. You know, I was downstairs, and that cute hipster barista was at the coffee shop, and I meant to say that it was a nice mocha, and instead I said, nice mustache. It was so embarrassing. And her friend laughs and says, that's a huge coincidence, because I also committed an embarrassing Freudian slip this morning. I was just at the breakfast table with my husband, and I meant to say, honey, could you pass the butter? And instead I said, you have ruined my life, you miserable human being. So in this conversation about the future of our habitat, the future of our species, I think very often we mean to say to each other, you know, we need to get together and think about this stuff and do the best things we know how to do to make a better world for our grandchildren. But instead, we're repeatedly telling each other that you are ruining my life, you miserable human being. We have an affection for feeling superior to other people. We feel superior in all kinds of ways. I know, by the way, I know the Mennonite method for feeling slightly superior and then very ashamed. I know. I once went fishing in Canada with a group of my Mennonite friends, and I learned that I had to leap out of the car while it was still rolling at the hotel to run in and book two rooms for the four men, right? Otherwise, I would have been sleeping with Randy Crable, right? Every night, right? So I know Randy feels, I mean, he's significantly more frugal than I am, and it's a point of pride, and I understand that. For all of us, one of the great temptations, by the way, I melted that fence. That's not a photographic problem there. You see the middle of that fence? It turns out that heavily varnished furniture, when you burn it, goes pretty hot. But nobody else has a fence like mine now. Only I have that. I think it's very hard to resist the temptation. But, you know, we're not going to be able to answer these questions as factions. We've got problems that we cannot browbeat other people into helping us solve. We have to agree. We have to reach unprecedented levels of consensus to limit our consumption, limit the size of our families, limit our expansion for the good of future generations. And yeah, that's a challenge of a pretty healthy scale. So I've been writing this next book. And I told my wife the idea for this next book. She said, "You were evidently unsatisfied with how poorly the first book sold." You know, what you always need is a supportive spouse. That's the... But I got this, I had this idea. I mean, I encountered another guy's idea, and I thought it was so stupid it gave me an idea. The other guy is a brilliant man, a genius, described by both himself and others, named Ray Kurzweil. And Ray's written a number of books. One of them's called Live Long Enough to Live Forever. And Ray's whole goal in life, his main goal in life, is to live forever. And his idea is, if he keeps himself healthy enough — he's actually a little older than me, he probably looks a little better than I do at the age, but anyway, he's a little older than me, and he's like getting blood transfusions every 6 weeks and taking all kinds of supplements and exercising, and he's doing a number of things I'm not doing, and he's not doing several things I am doing, I realize that, so that he'll be here when technology gets to the point where he will never die. And that's batshit crazy. If we cured cancer today, we'd have to build another New York City every year from now on to accommodate the people who didn't die of cancer, with all of its concrete and all of its sewage treatment and everything else you can think of, and it would smell just as bad as the current New York City does. If we succeeded in lengthening human lives by 20 years tomorrow with some sort of medical breakthrough, then we'd have to build 8 more New York cities every year to accommodate the people who didn't die during that 20 years, because we had lengthened everybody's lifespan. Now, science is pursuing the lengthening of human life as its primary objective. And we are spending trillions of dollars on research to accomplish this goal. And you know what? With our track record, we might do it. And then this gets really ugly. Then we've got a real challenge to confront. That challenge is we're going to have to die voluntarily if we don't die mandatorily. See what I mean about the book not probably selling very well? So I'm thinking, well, I'm going to get some pushback from some members of my community who are biblical conservatives. And I think, well, I should just read the Gospels. I never have. And not just ours. I read the Bhagavad Gita, and I read the Torah, and I read the Quran, this and that. And then I got, and I read the Judeo-Christian Bible for the first time chronologically. And I'd read this and that and the other thing. I read the Old Testament first. That is some weird stuff in there. How many of y'all know what King David brought to King Saul as a gift so that he could marry Saul's daughter? How many of y'all know what the gift was? Anybody? There's one. Two. Anybody want to shout it out? I don't think so. 200 Philistine foreskins. 200 Philistine foreskins. I've looked up the translation. They're not wrong. Some scholars believe you could expand the definition slightly beyond foreskin. I'll leave that alone. Boy, the Old Testament, huh? And you know that God's people went around killing every man, woman, and child in one place after another, because that's what God wanted them to do. So that was an experience that I didn't expect to have reading the Bible. And then I got to the New Testament. I had another experience I didn't expect to have. You remember what my goal was, right? I was probably 2/3 of the way through the New Testament before it occurred to me what the central story in the New Testament is. It is that a young man, evidently the most gifted of young men ever, gave up his life voluntarily with God's permission in order to make the world a better place. Wow. I told my wife, that book sold great. So there. What if our faith is based on a story that's a kind of mythological time bomb set to go off when we really need it? Possibly after 2,000 or 2,500 years of profound misunderstanding about its meaning. What if our faith is a mandate that we must learn individually, one person at a time, to give up our attachment to our egos and to acknowledge that each of us has a greater responsibility to future generations, and that each of us must really sacrifice the place we take up on this planet for other creatures and future generations of people. Well, that made my hair stand on end. And then one of the weirdest things that ever happened to me happened. I went to Walmart, and the people there looked beautiful to me. You do acknowledge that's pretty weird, right? You've been to Walmart. You know who I'm talking about, right? No, I thought, every one of these people has the potential, every human being has the capacity to give up his or her life for the good of others. And I frankly had never seen people that way before. And it made people look kind of beautiful to me and made me feel very differently about the people in line at the airport for security screening, who I had previously resented because they were in front of me. What if? Well, if that is the mandate, it puts our work in a completely different light. And it puts our acquisition of wealth in a completely different light. And it puts everything about human existence and human experience in a completely different life. If we wake up in the morning ready to give ours up for the greater good, and instead of the acquisition of wealth, instead of the, I hope, looming purchase of my first Tesla automobile, it's not really, it's my hope, I said. Somebody was going to congratulate me. No, I'm just dreaming. But what if it puts it all in a completely different light and purpose? You know, faith creates the awareness. And the awareness is that purpose and meaning in our work are by far the most important things. And they are the most underrated aspects of compensation, of professional compensation, by far. And I think you all, many of you have already had that experience, that you'd be happy to make less money in exchange for more meaning. And in fact, if you could feel it, you'd be happy to share the money you have with others if it gives your life more meaning. And I think that's fundamental, fundamental to who we are as human beings. In closing, now that I've got you all thinking that I'm completely insane, I'll just say on my own behalf, what if I told you that every human society would find it completely ethical, moral, and necessary to send young people to die while trying to kill other young people for purposes they do not understand? I don't think what I am suggesting is any crazier. So, it's kind of what I hope is that we might change our idea of heroism, and that we might come to understand the human capacity for truly heroic compassion. Thanks.
Stay up.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Brian, for covering so much ground in 50 minutes, about 4,000 years, I think.
I keep it shallow, David.
I'm going to invite Rachel to join us up front, and the three of us will form a panel that you will be invited to respond to in any way that you like, with a question, with a comment. I'm going to give you a couple of minutes, though, to reflect, first of all, on what question you might want to ask or what comment you might want to make, and to do that quietly with yourself, look back over your notes. We've talked about identity, we've talked about faith, we've talked about hope, we've talked about change. So what are some of the things that you want to address to these two speakers? Some of you are newly arrived this evening, so I want to mention our colleague Janine Oberg, who is next to me. Janine is a Center for Justice and Peacebuilding alumna, and we ask her to be the artist in residence during these couple of days. So she is collecting and reflecting on themes that she is hearing and is already, as you can see, emerging from a book to something that is taking wing. And we're going to invite her to talk about that at the end of our days together. So I want to give you now this time to respond. And just to refresh your memory, some of the themes that Rachel talked about, the desire for being empowered by our Anabaptist identity, but the reality that can also lead to domination, given that American Mennonites, at least many of us, not all, have acquired wealth and privilege. And she talked about white privilege and patriarchy and what that results in, the ability to not have to think about that privilege. But the fact that Anabaptist identity is rooted in a narrative of persecution and suffering gives us something to connect with that perhaps can allay some of that. And then you just finished listening to Brian's comments. There's much that I could highlight. One thing that I will, and then we'll get your comments, has to do with one of the most important movements shaping the 21st century is people with a passion for using business as a force for good. And that relates very much to the theme of this conference, seeing leadership as a force for the common good, and something that we teach in our programs here as well. So we have two individuals with mics, and we would appreciate if you could signal to either of them, and you can direct your comments specifically or simply to the panel that's here.
For Brian, hey, I'm back here.
Hi.
I was wondering, how does money play into giving to the next generation, specifically for like your family, as you possibly haven't had the money to provide a life that could allow for giving up money almost?
Huh. Let me see if I understand the question correctly then. So how does it play to my family, or how does the fact that I've had resources play in the context of the idea of sacrifice?
Okay. So, like, I guess in my situation, I don't come from a rich family.
Yeah.
And so I don't feel like I have the ability to give money or something like that, or sacrifice that.
Yeah.
And so my goal in life pretty much is to raise enough money for my children so that they don't have to do the same things that I have to do, and they can enjoy life more.
Huh. Yeah, very cool. I also came from a family of origin that didn't have money, and I didn't get money that way. And I have felt that impulse. Somewhere along the line, I only have one child. And somewhere along the line, she decided that she did not want any of our resources to be passed down to her as an inheritance or anything like that. Now, we educated her, you know, paid for her education. I usually pay for lunch if we go out. Seems like a first step toward voluntary mortality to me. My wife and I intend to give it away, whatever there is, and not bequeath it to our child. And I don't know. She has two children, so we have two grandchildren. And frankly, I haven't even thought about whether to change our ideas for their sake, because our notion was to share it more widely. Yeah, it's a good thing you raised the issue, because obviously I haven't thought about it very carefully. We just had this general idea. We kind of put it in place a long time ago and left it be. I think what I would probably conclude is, I really admire friends of mine who gave their grandchildren a small bequest and then distributed most of their estates elsewhere. I'm not sure big bequests are a good idea for anybody. You know, I'm not sure they improve the lives of the heirs. But time for me to think about it a bit more. What I've done with this new business may make it unnecessary to consider. Thanks for asking, though.
So let me invite those of you who are commenting to stand so the rest of us can see you, if you would.
My name is James Miller. First, just wanted to thank both of the speakers. I felt a stirring kind of inside of me, I think, from the things you were sharing and the juxtaposition of the two. First, you showed us the greatest quality of a leader, perhaps, the ability to stir a bucket of... I don't know, I think that's basically one of the greatest qualities of that. I wrote down a couple things that you were talking about. You talked about purpose and meaning, and she was talking about our heritage as Mennonites. At my church, we have a lot of artists somehow, We were talking about Mennonites and art. And one of the things we talked about the last week was the way that Mennonites found purpose and meaning in life out of working the land. And I think about where the University Commons is right now. Used to be a beautiful patch of raspberries that my grandpa Sam used to plant. He was a Spanish professor here. But I think in our heritage as Mennonites, we do bring special things for this instant that we're at, that you're talking about, this moment of anxiety. There's skills and abilities in our Mennonite heritage, and that is to find in the simplicity in life, beauty and art. And that's part of our hope. You talked about hope. I don't see hope as much about being able to fly in 60 years. I see hope under some suspenders and in a horse and buggy, which is where my heritage comes from. Because there are Mennonites, and those Mennonites who have those qualities, I think, still have a lot to teach to a lot of us Mennonites who've been getting a little bit more into the flying realm. They teach us to return to our roots, to go back to that, finding the simplicity in the beauty and being present in the everyday. So those are more or less what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mennonites and raspberries. You want to come in?
As my body develops and matures, I wear suspenders much more often. I don't know if that's some kind of cultural thing or...
I'll give one to each of you then. We'll give Rachel a chance to talk too. I was moved by the end of your speech, Brian, where you talked about all the different religious texts. We live in a time that's very divisive, so I'd like to know, what did you find amongst all of those texts to unify us rather than divide us? And Rachel, as you talked about being divided based on our classifications of people, in your conversations, what have you found that unites us rather than divides us among all people, say, your age?
You'll go first?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for that question. I appreciate it. And I guess that is the idea of finding unity in our generation is something that does give me a lot of hope. I don't know if it's unique to the setting I find myself in here at EMU, but I have the sense that it is larger than this community, of our generation having a sense of the world is about to change, and we know that. Resources are scarce. None of us can find full-time work. I'm about to graduate. It's sort of these new realities that we face. Experiencing a sense of unity in that, and that there is struggle to come. And I think there's a certain level of bonding that we feel in knowing that the emerging world is one that will need each other's support as sort of a human body. Without the realms and borders of nation state and separation across political lines and racial lines, knowing that we're all gonna face the struggle in the years to come. And so we need to be together in that.
Rachel, did you happen to notice that question was framed more or less to ask you about the future and me about the past? Did you notice that? I don't mind. As I said, my work has led me to a strong conviction that if I can generalize the idea of doing good, if I can strip out a sense of superiority or tribal identity. When I say tribal identity, this is not a reference to primitive peoples in any way. I realize it's sometimes heard that way. But the only way I have to accurately describe the groups we set ourselves in. Did you know that the Dutch people have a word that means goat hair sock wearing people that describes people who wear Birkenstocks with their socks? I cannot say the word, but it is a thing. There is this tendency to arrange ourselves in tribes of various sizes, and we develop languages that are unique to those tribes and modes of dress. And we habitually and chronically separate ourselves from others in this way. And then we describe doing good in different ways. And we convince ourselves that we are doing good while the other is not. And I think that's highly destructive, and that the antidote to that is to find ways of describing good that are generalized and that appeal to larger audiences. And obviously this is coming from a person who does storytelling for a living and has my whole adult life. So I think of storytelling as an important tool in this. But I certainly find that you can gather extremely diverse groups of people together and in a very short time frame bring them into fellowship if you focus on the important opportunity of doing something good in the world. And we don't fundamentally disagree about what is good. So I actually have a lot of confidence in us in that way. And I have been, you know, the vast majority of the time I encounter people who have deeply positive aspirations to treat other people well and to do good in the world. So I basically think of people, of human beings as fundamentally good, and regret, the fear, the divisiveness, the separation that we create by any means. I'm not sure I answered the question at all, but felt good to say it.
I'd like to talk about the B Corporation idea a little bit more.
Great.
We have all the societal ill, everything from homelessness to, you know, drug addiction, and we think about trying to solve that as a society, and we think that there's a real role for government, and government does run a lot of programs. And then we think there's a lot of role for charitable organizations to get involved in churches to play a role in dealing with society's ills. But if you look at the total spend of the government, and you look at the total spend of the charitable entities, it is a drop in the bucket compared to the total amount of economic activity that happens on the for-profit side of the corporate ledger. And so this idea that we as a society can go and identify the businesses that are socially responsible, that pay a living wage, that treat the environment appropriately, is an idea that I really like. In fact, there's a group of us in Lancaster exploring this idea that we should certify companies that operate at this highest level, because it's really truly up to the business community to solve these corporate ills. But when I think about this, I'm pretty cynical. Because when it comes to social investing, after this being an idea that we've had for a long period of time, we've only gotten 15% of our equity investors in socially responsible companies. So what makes you think that this idea is going to gain traction and that we're actually going to get corporate America to come and turn around and solve society's ills with some kind of brand of B that gives them this good housekeeping seal that's going to change society? I'm pretty cynical about that idea. So would you tell us how you think this is going to happen?
Well, I'm just incredibly encouraged by the fact that you've listened to everything I've said tonight and you still want to know my opinion about something. the industrial economy is about 300 years old. That's not very long. Adam Smith wrote Wealth of Nations 240 years ago. He had this idea that enlightened self-interest was the solution to society's problems, and that the invisible hand, it turns out the invisible hand of greed, would somehow make everybody better off. And in fact, it has, you know, private enterprise has made a lot of people better off in various ways. But I just remind folks that this idea of free enterprise is extremely young. And like an adolescent boy, it has not yet acknowledged that its actions have consequences. It continues, you know, lots of people have loved Adam Smith's idea of enlightened self-interest. And he went so far as to say, oh, they'll do lots more good in the world if they're not trying to do good in the world. And I think he was just pandering to the first wave of wealthy industrialists, who he knew would support him for the rest of his life. I think as a scholar, that's what he was doing, and I think he succeeded. So that's obviously been a super popular idea, that businesses should just go around what they're doing for money, and that it'll all turn out great in the end, and we shouldn't ask them to do more than that. I just think it's a sort of dumb idea in the early part of the history of human endeavor in business, and that we're just growing up. You know, I think that the B Corporation idea is simply a logical step in the maturation of our definitions of businesses and what they should do. I think business is the most powerful organizer of human energy we've ever devised. And we've been astonished by how powerful it is. And we've used it in dumb, short-sighted ways. And we can grow up and stop using it that way. That's my feeling, for what it's worth.
The adolescent boy metaphor is worth thinking more about. That's fascinating.
Adolescent boys of all ages, right?
Thank you. That's what motivated me to ask you this question. As I sit up and listen to you and Rachel, I mean, beautiful, beautiful session. You funny. You got jokes.
Funny ha-ha or the other kind of funny?
Funny ha-ha-ha.
Oh, thank you.
Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. No. As a person who comes from the streets of Philadelphia, and I lived on the other side of the track for many years, and I'm listening and I'm thinking about King David, how he received the title from God, a man after my own heart. But yet he had so much blood on his hands.
Yeah.
Then going into the New Testament, I'm looking at Christ and the Good Samaritan story. When they came to ask him crazy questions, well, who is thy neighbor? And then Jesus gives the story of the Good Samaritan. Then he said, go do likewise. However, there are many young African-American men and women who are released from incarceration, and as a result, they are ostracized from societal resources.
Yeah.
No one want to touch them.
Yeah.
No company. In Philadelphia, the mayor had a $10,000 tax credit to any company that would just hire ex-offenders. Nobody, they didn't want to touch it. And listening to you and filling your spirit, because I love a spiritual person, not a religious person, a spiritual person. And looking at that, one of my goals for coming to EMU is to be that example to that community that I come from and show them that you can get up and you can move forward. However, it's going to take brothers and sisters like you guys,
yeah,
to teach these brothers, young men, how to start a business. Because the doors is not closed to them. They just don't know how.
No.
What can you offer from that perspective?
Mm. God, that's a beautiful observation and a hard question. I couldn't agree more strongly. Both the rate of incarceration in our country, the demographic of incarceration in our country, and then the ostracization of the formerly incarcerated folks, it's not only an enormous injustice, but it's damn stupid social policy, alienating so many hundreds of thousands of people from society and its benefits has horrible potential consequences. I think your idea of training entrepreneurs is a brilliant idea. And teaching people how to create their own economic justice through business is a brilliant idea. Not an easy idea to execute, but a brilliant idea. I will point to one example in the business world that I think has given us a couple of important insights. Grayston Bakeries, are you familiar with Grayston Bakeries? Grayston Bakery is based in Yonkers. A friend of mine, Bernie Glassman, started it 20 years ago. And Bernie's from Yonkers, and you may be aware, Yonkers, an impoverished community, tough place, you know, three and four generations of families that have never really participated in the economy, haven't had jobs. Many people have been incarcerated, been on social, you know, been on welfare. Just a tough place. Bernie's idea was, well, these folks don't know how to interview for a job. They have been, many of them have been incarcerated, which, of course, is a black mark. You know, there's going to be competitors for the jobs that haven't been incarcerated. They have never maybe had a job. How can I create jobs for the folks who most need them? And he decided he can't pay any attention to any of the qualifiers. So he does, he invented this thing he calls open hiring, where if you go down to Grayston Bakery, and Grayston Bakery is a big industrial bakery, they create brownies in that get shipped all over the place. It's not a local bakery, it's an industrial bakery. If you go down there, you get a number. And when your number comes up in turnover, they hire you. And you go to work. And the first 30 or 45 days you're employed there, you're told, if you show up on time every morning and you stay all day, then at the end of this period, you'll move on from this introductory period and you'll become a baker in training. And you'll be certified for food safety, you'll learn how to be an industrial baker. But the first 30 or 45 days, I'm sorry, I can't remember specifically, is just show up on time, stay all day. And so what he did was he removed all of the screening. And all people need to do is show up and sign up. Now, the current CEO of that company, they had tried to make new Grayston bakeries around the country. Difficult to capitalize. In communities where it wasn't trusted, it was very hard to get it started, you know what I mean? You'd put it in a community that needed it, but then it was just, they were outsiders and they couldn't get track. It was hard. So they have a new idea. And they have bought a big abandoned mansion in Yonkers. And in April or May, they have scheduled the opening of the Open Hiring Institute. And they're using philanthropy to provide training for anyone who wants to attend the Open Hiring Institute so they can learn how to start their own open hiring business in their own community. So for me, that's just a really cool example of how you can scale an idea. And I think open hiring is one step, is one technique, it's one resource that could create part of the change you're describing. I wish I had 17 examples that were that exciting to me, but I don't. And thank you very much for raising the issue and asking the question.
Steve, anybody on your side? Okay. Roxy, anyone on your side still wanting to comment?
I have a question about the B Corporation also. Is the standard or the assessment that has been established such that it's so difficult for a corporation to be able to achieve it, or are there steps along the way that corporations can work towards and kind of get there rather than such a high standard that they can't readily achieve? And secondly, how about nonprofit corporations? Are they in any way included in this standard that is established for B Corporations?
Thanks for asking the question. Nonprofits cannot be B Corporations. That's just not something we've addressed. It's not something our, you know, the group of leaders that have been involved with this, we decided we had to limit the scope. And we couldn't figure out a way that nonprofits and for-profits could be put on an even playing field. I think we'd be excited to hear someone is doing something similar, but it's not something that our community is doing. 40,000 businesses are using the assessment as a management tool. 1,700 of them have certified, but 40,000 of them are using the assessment
to measure different aspects of their business and as a stepping stone to move toward higher levels of responsibility. Those 40,000 have all completed at least half of the assessment, completed it, and it includes lots of documentation. So it's time-consuming and hard. They've made a serious commitment to it. So I think it's useful in that interim way you describe, but it's a go or no-go in terms of certification. There aren't, like, there's no silver level of B certification or bronze level of B certification. You either are or you're not. That's how it's set up. It is inspiring to me that Paul Polman, who's the CEO of Unilever, which is one of the largest consumer products companies in the world, is publicly working towards certification. It's a company on a par with Procter & Gamble. Laureate Education is an $8 billion international company with 80,000 employees, and it is a B Corporation. The large publicly traded beauty products company Natura in Brazil is a B Corporation. So among the 1,700, they aren't all, hand-making soap out of small storefronts in Vermont, which is a preconception some folks have. There's great diversity, and some of the companies are very large and have invested millions in getting to the certification. Does that answer the question?
So we would take time for one more question or comment, if there is one.
There's one back. Okay.
Start in the back, and then we'll take the second.
Maybe we'll take two more.
Go ahead, Ken.
All right. I appreciate both of your presentations, and one of the things that that brought them together is that in growing up Mennonite, I went to a school where a teacher had on the wall, "Whoever has no people has no God." And so I think identifying with the question of what makes us Anabaptist is a part of being part of a community. On the other hand, I went to Africa with Eastern Mennonite Missions, and the hardest question I was asked was, "What tribe are you from?" And so I'm wondering, as both of you are talking, as we're moving into this age of wanting to really connect with the whole world, yet maintain our unique identity, how do we address the issue of tribalism for ourselves? How would each of you say what tribe you are from? And then how do you keep that from excluding those who are not part of the in-group that you're a part of in your tribe?
What was the first question again? I'm sorry.
The first question is, what tribe are you from?
Oh, okay.
And secondly, if tribalism is a problem, how do we then identify and treat the out-group members and maintain a connection with the idea that those who have no people have no God?
That's great.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Ken. In terms of what tribe do you identify with, a story comes to mind for me. The summer after my sophomore year of college, I was interning at a church on the south side of Chicago, which is a predominantly black community. So the women I went to church with were all young black women who I got to get pretty close with that summer. And one day we were talking about race, and they were like, "Rachel, you're not white." I was like, "Oh, like, I'm not?" They're like, "No, you're Irish." And so somehow, even though, like, it's my grandfather who immigrated when he was a child.
Like, there's no word for whiter than white.
Right, so you must be something. Exactly. Exactly. So to them, I was Irish. And so this idea of perception of tribe and identity of tribe being so ambiguous, and the same with my dad grew up Mennonite, my mom is Catholic, so am I Mennonite, am I Catholic, and connecting that to what mixed race individuals feel, they're perceived as black. If you're both black and white, people see you as black. But then maybe you're too white in the black community, or vice versa. And so I guess my response to that would be, I think there is value in identity and being proud and empowered in your identity. So like as a woman, I feel empowered in that identity. And there's a connectedness to fellow women. The same, I think, can be true in groups based on race, based on religion. But this idea that maybe there is no such thing as a tribe, because you can tell me I'm one thing and I perceive myself as another. And so connecting to each other based on our experience and our ability to emotionally connect to other human beings, and seeing those other factors that do make a difference in the way people are treated in our society, and being aware of those barriers that we put up, but focusing on the things that do connect us, and sort of the human emotion that can't be denied.
Thank you. Anything, Brian?
I suppose I should, although that was so good, I'm tempted.
We can just leave it.
No, I won't leave it. wouldn't be like me. I think I do have something to share on that, although I'll say at the outset that I probably came to the profession of journalism in part because I never had a good instinct for joining groups, and so I always loved being on the perimeter of things. And so it's a natural, just emotional setting. And so I think I speak to the question of community in some ways rather poorly, because I don't have the same, I don't have all the same background for it that some folks do. I will say, though, that we call our annual stockholders meeting in my new company a community of purpose. It's called our community of purpose gathering. And our notion is that we were forming a community around a purpose. And after we named it, I was just reflecting that most of the communities I belong to are in some way, shape, or form communities of purpose. And so I would say that I'm probably a member of dozens of communities that are profoundly important to me, all of them formed around accomplishing one thing or another. And I love the sensation of working with other people toward a common goal more than I enjoy exercising secret handshakes. Although I think we have to acknowledge that one of the reasons religions tend to believe crazy stuff is because it does separate them from other groups. And that's how we used to survive, was by forming really strong social groups that could protect us against antagonists. And those groups were stronger if you believed something that not everybody would believe, and so virtually every tribal religion believes something that not everyone would just naturally believe. I'm a Quaker. Quakers believe all rational stuff, and I think at last count there were 7 or 8 of us in the world. The Mormons, meanwhile, grow and grow. So mechanically, there seems to be something important about that. How do I try not to alienate others? Well, my profanity is a problem, but, I try to go around believing that I don't understand anything that you couldn't understand. I try to understand things you understand that I don't, and I just try not to hold any beliefs that I don't think I can share with others, which gives me really bad boundaries in some ways. But I think that's fundamental. As soon as I tell you that you can't understand me, I've put up a barrier that cannot be overcome. As soon as I believe that I cannot understand you, I've put up a boundary that cannot be overcome. And I think that's a bad idea.
I think I just met a Quaker who can preach. I want to honor the last comment or question.
The other question got answered, so he's, yeah.
So everything that has wanted or needed to be asked has been asked? Okay. I want to just comment that you had a fascinating quote, Brian, and it
just
had
one
that I'm going to finish with. Optimists are more attractive than pessimists. Nobody follows a pessimist. I'll have to confess I've watched a couple of primary debates lately. And pessimism is having a really good run. So remind us of why you remain hopeful in the midst of the pessimism.
Oh, you know, the politics. Are those folks running for the presidency trying to be leaders? Is that what they're doing? I think they're trying to exercise power. And I do not think that the dialogue that we're listening to is a dialogue about leadership. It's a dialogue about fear, a dialogue about tribe, a dialogue about division, an attempt to segment the population in a way that gives one an advantage. But I think it's categorically not a conversation about the kind of leadership that would improve the world for the next generation. So
you're calling us to a different kind of leadership and a different kind of messaging around hope and faith.
Well, I think that I do think it's absolutely mandatory to leadership to do it with both hope and faith. But I don't, and I just don't think that the people currently running for the president of the United States are interested in leadership. I think they're interested in power, and it's different.
Well, let's please thank both of these individuals and also Janine. We look forward to welcoming you back here tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning. See you then.